grey and moist, and wind and sea, me town dealing, and waves swelling, me glore mara, and ocean's voice. May thou shaft Gorok and stag of seven clashes. May fuller isle and falcon on cliff. May dior drought of wing rain and sunlit dewdrop. May oilocht fosh and rarest of herbs. May turk gael. I'm boar enraged, may bradon selin, I'm salmon in pool. May loch va, I'm lake in plain, may sea agina, I'm fortified hilltop. May gaff we voa a slee sacha. I'm sharpened spear dealing death. May dia a einen tinna sechaun. I'm God who kindles fire in the head.
These are the opening lines of an extraordinary poem, The Song of Amagin, said to be Ireland's earliest poem and translated here from the original medieval Irish by the poet Paddy Bush. Legend says that the song was spontaneously recited by Amagin, the poet, sailor, prince of the Milesians, when he stepped from his boat in Ballinskellig's Bay and placed his right foot on the shore of Ireland for the first time.
Who makes smooth the stony mountain? Who elucidates the lives of the moon? Who proclaims where the sun will rest? Who leads the stars like cattle from the ocean? On whom do those stars smile? What troop, what god, edges blades in a plague-struck fortress? Keening of weapons, keening of wind.
It's a chant in which the poet declares his profound affinity with all aspects of the natural world. He's clearly very much alive to the beauties of nature, but he claims more than that. He identifies too with the active energies of a creative interior life, with the spark that fires the mind and inspires learning and the skills of the poet. The roots of the song reach back into the mists of prehistory, to an ancestral civilization now lost to us, a time long before Christianity arrived in Ireland. But we first encountered the Song of Amagin in the form in which we know it today in the 11th century manuscript, the Book of Invasions. Dr. Kelly Fitzgerald from the School of Irish, Celtic Studies and Folklore at University College Dublin has a particular interest in early medieval Irish.
The Lara Gwalaerin, the Book of Invasions, is one of the most significant texts compiled throughout the early medieval period here in Ireland. And what we have now is an 11th century compilation after generations of scribes writing and rewriting. And I suppose we have to remember where material like this is coming from in Ireland. It is Christianity that brings literacy to that extent to Ireland. And it is in the monasteries that this material is composed, is transcribed, is brought together.
And what distinguishes the Book of Invasions, and indeed much of the early Irish manuscript material, is that it's not written in Latin, the language of the church, but in Irish.
Really, what is one of the most fascinating aspects of early Irish material, and as we look at the development of literacy in Ireland and the manuscript tradition, we see that the Irish begin to write in the vernacular much earlier and sooner than other people or other peoples across Europe. And there's quite a sense of pride. You have to remember that Christianity is the cosmopolitan trend of the time. It is the international engagement. But saying that, they'd had a pride, and there is a sense of who they were as a people before their engagement with Christianity. And in a way, Lár Gaillimh and the Book of Invasions is kind of reclaiming that pagan past and putting it into a Christian framework and giving huge importance to that heritage and the necessity for that heritage to be documented.
The Book of Invasions recounts the development of agriculture, the clearing of plains and the growing of crops, the building of forts, the development of metalwork, and also the development of the social order and legal structures, the sense of kingship and hierarchy, which were believed to be already established before the arrival of the Sons of Mill from northern Spain. So the Book of Invasions attempts to explain Irish society and culture and show why things are the way they are. Remove, we can't know how much of the Song of Amagin, as recorded in the Book of Invasions, is the work of the medieval monks who transcribed it, and how much is the authentic voice of an earlier civilization. Certainly, the story of the Milesians coming to Ireland refers to a pre-Christian era, and it may well be that the essentials of the poem are, at the least, a clear echo from an ancient past.
The people of knowledge have told us that the Sons of Mill came to Ireland from that part of northern Spain we now call Galicia. It was Eith, the son of Bregon, who first saw Ireland. He spied it while gazing out from the top of Bregon's tower. It was a clear winter's evening, and his sight was keen. Looking out across the travelling waves, Eith could see the dim outline of a distant land beyond the horizon. And he saw the smoke of home fires rising in the sky from its settlements. With courage in his heart and a love of adventure, Eith resolved to voyage to this distant land. And so it was that he set sail together with 150 warriors. This was the time when the Tuatha Dé Danann held possession of Ireland. And so when Eith arrived on the coast, he travelled across the country to meet the three kings of the Tuatha Dé Danann. Eith was a man of great wisdom, and it soon became clear to all that his understanding surpassed that of the kings and judges of the Tuatha Dé Danann. These kings must have feared that Eith would find favour with the people and usurp their power, because they plotted to kill him, and he was murdered in a place that thereafter was called the Plain of Eith. When his corpse was brought home to Spain, the sons of Mill, who were his kinsmen, were outraged and determined to avenge him. And so it was that Amagin, the poet and lawmaker of the Milesians, together with his brothers, set sail for Ireland. As the slender vessels of the Milesians approached the Kerry coast in Ballinskellig's Bay, Amagin stepped out from his boat and set his right foot on Ireland. And as he did, spontaneously and unbidden, his tongue recited the glorious chant we now call the Song of Amagin.
I am the wind gusting over the ocean. I am the wave as it reaches the shore. I am the sound of the waves everlasting, the sound of the sea as it roars. I am a hawk high over the clifftop. I am a stag roaming mighty and strong. I am a clear and transparent dewdrop, a sparkling tear of the sun.
Immediately after chanting his song, Amagin does something very practical. He recites another chant, this time to increase the fish in the rivers and lakes.
Fish-filled sea, fertile land, inundation of fish, fish under waves, flocking like birds, wind-whipped sea, myriad flashings, salmon in hundreds, plump as whales, a shoreline song, inundation of fish, fish-filled sea.
It's well known that Amagin was a man of great honour, and when he approached the three kings of Ireland in Tara, they pleaded to be allowed a truce of 3 days in which to gather an army. Amagin agreed and said that all the Milesian ships would go back out on the sea, back beyond the nine blue waves, before approaching Ireland again, as that was the lawful manner of occupying land. Amagin and the Milesians returned to their ships in Ballinskellig's Bay and sailed back out, out beyond the nine blue waves. But the druids among the Tuatha De Danann cast spells and caused winds and storms to rise, throwing the Milesian boats into confusion. Daun, the Dark One, the elder brother of Amagin, said, "This is a disgrace to the people of Skill." "It will not be a disgrace," said Amagin, as he stood at the bow of his ship and recited this invocation. "Surging is the mighty sea, mighty is the upland full of meadows. Full of meadows is the rainy wood, rainy is the river full of waterfalls. Full of waterfalls is the spreading lake, spreading is the spring of multitudes. A spring of peoples is the assembly of the king of Tara. Tara is a tower of tribes, the tribes of the son of Mill, warriors of ships, of vessels." At once the winds were calmed, and the Milesians were able yet again to set foot on Ireland, this time to conquer the land completely.
The whole Milesian story became very much part of an Irish national narrative, particularly after the 17th century when Seachrún Caitin or Geoffrey Keaton retold the story in Forras Fasa ar Éireann. And through the 19th century, for example, the whole Milesian thing as an Irish national movement, whether that was violent nationalism or O'Connell's more peaceful sort of nationalism, the Milesian story became part of it. O'Connell wore what he called a Milesian cap for that he was presented with for most of his life. And interestingly, Tomás Ruaidh O'Sullivan, the great poet who was a protege of Daniel O'Connell, referred to him as O'Connell Gael the Four Vilacious, Bright O'Connell of the Seed of Milesius. So even in the 19th century, to show somebody's ancient Irish lineage, you talked of them as being of the Seed of Milesius. It shows you just how much importance was given to the myth in the mind of somebody like Tomás Ruaidh.
The details of the natural world, as described by Amigan, perfectly fit the South Kerry coast where the events in the Milesian legend are said to have taken place. Paddy Bush lives close to Ballinskellig's Bay, where Amigan first pulled in his boats.
The animal life of the area, the bird life of the area, is easily recognisable, I think, in Amigan's song. Not specifically, I think, this area. The same thing could apply to any place up along the western coast. You know, deer, eagles or falcons on cliff, a lake and salmon, furs, that sort of animal flora and fauna. The west coast of Ireland is very recognisable in it.
But it's the place names that specifically tie the Song of Amigan to the Waterville and Ballinskellig's area.
The most specifically named one is Lough Ligdach, or modern Irish Lough Liach, which is the Irish version of the name of Lough Carán. And it specifies that particular name. Other place names like Ceann Muicce or Pig's Head or Hog's Head on the southern arm of Ballinskellig's Bay, that is referred to because it says the Tuatha Dé Danann raised a magic storm to try and stop the Milesians landing, and they shaped Ireland to look like a pig's back. It also mentions Skellig, that a brother of Amigan drowned and was buried on Skellig. It mentions the Bull Rach or Teach Dean, that Down, the rather sinister brother of Amigan, a death figure, his name literally means the dark one, was drowned and buried down there. And then in a very interesting local variation, Carrig Éanna, lies just offshore from my house. And in a 17th century poem by a man called Sean O'Connell, who lived up in Cahirbarna on the north side of the lake, wrote a poem called Tirriv na Héireann, where he did a retelling of that myth. And he said, Atai bon charan fosk an treach an charig ler cailag gashachlach éana, that at the bottom of the Carán River, there's still to be found the rock where tragically Éanna was drowned. Éanna, I think, is a corruption or a change in the name Éireannán, who had said, you know, was drowned when he was thrown from the mast. And even this morning, I kayaked out to Carrig Éanna and I was sitting there, seals circling around me, and that whole old story of the Milesians. It was echoing around inside my head. And I think that local association with story, even if they're not factual stories, creates a bond between people and place that I think is very important in how we engage with the place we live in.
My love was a river, and she flowed by the bower. Gave her wild lilies to wear for her name. I'm still here by the ocean with its restless turn. ocean, just waiting to see my sweet lover again. My love was a mermaid when I was a sailor. Haul up the anchor and hoist up the sails. Oh, how many good men on the high followed after, caught in a promise to cut through the veils. My love was a blackbird when the season late was turning. I heard her singing deep in the green wood late. I stood still, I stood enchanted, her voice like bright silver, and all the world surrendered to the music she made. I'm still waiting by the ocean with its restless turning motion, just waiting to see my sweet lover again.
Of course, throughout the ages, poets have turned to nature and drawn inspiration from her many faces. Chaucer begins the Canterbury Tales with a vivid description of spring, referring to the sweet breath of the breeze and the small birds that make melodies. And Shakespeare sees nature as a teacher when he speaks of tongues in trees, books in running brooks, and sermons in stones. The Song of Amagin is a poem that suggests layers of meaning while remaining an enigma at its heart. It offers a litany of striking images drawn from the natural world. The swelling wave, the hawk on the cliff, the proud stag wandering the hills, and the sparkling dewdrop, which is described as a tear of the sun. And it conveys an awareness of the cosmic, the sun and the moon and the stars, and the place of mankind in the universe. And the poet also poses fundamental questions about the riddle of existence. Who forms the mountains? Who leads the stars across the sky? The poet also identifies with a sharpened spear and a voice crying in the wind. I was curious as to how others responded to this mysterious work. David Ellison is a teacher in Dublin, and he relates the Song of Amagin and that image of the sparkling dewdrop to his own experience of nature.
I remember seeing for the first time, I was probably 30, or seeing a blade of grass with this globule, this dewdrop, hanging from it, like a lantern. So perfect, and it is extraordinary when you look at it. And then you see the other dewdrops, you see the other blades of grass all have this, but it's only manageable to look at one. There's so much beauty in one. And then you see the grass, you see the simplicity of the blade of grass, because the jewel or the dewdrop has caught the sun and has caught your attention, and then you're drawn to the blade of grass. So it's an extraordinary, nature is, it's too extraordinary to be random in my, that is my sense. It's too extraordinary, it's too complementary, it's too harmonious. There is a diversity, we talk of biodiversity, the diversity of life. It's just, there's more life in a potted plant than there is on the planet Jupiter. Even though human beings have sent, we have been able to slingshot spaceships out to the far reaches of the solar system, and they are extraordinary to look at, the gas giants, but the life that grows on Earth is extraordinary and it cannot be explained.
McGee-based sculptor Holger C. Lunds was commissioned by Kerry County Council to create a work celebrating the Yamagin story. Cast in bronze and standing over 6 metres tall on the seafront at Waterville, the work was unveiled on St. Bridget's Day last year. It takes the form of a sundial, which, when viewed from different angles, becomes the prow of a ship or the head of a gannet, surrounded by curving waves. For Holger, the initial challenge was the fact that Yamagin was a mythical rather than an historical figure.
So that made it very difficult. Where would you, in which period would you set it? What area would you set it in? What would be a costume if you go for a figurative piece? How would he be dressed? What did he look like? It's very difficult if that's mythology rather than history. So I decided to approach it from a completely different angle and look at navigation in prehistoric times. So if there were any Milesians, any people from Spain coming to Ireland, which they obviously did, because we have a lot of prehistoric references to connection between Spain and Ireland. But how did they get here? How would they have navigated? What kind of boat would they have used? So that all became very interesting for me, and I wanted to bring that into the sculpture piece. So I decided to kind of look at navigation in the Bronze Age. So I started reading books by different archaeologists, maritime archaeologists, looking what kind of boat was there. And there were plank boats around, but the main boat were skin boats, like the Corrochs we have in Ireland. But they had different ways of navigating, obviously. They had no charts, they had no compass, that wasn't invented, there was no astrolabe invented, they only came in the medieval times. So if this whole Milesian myth was set in prehistoric times, in pre-medieval times, they had to have different ways of coming here. So they would have navigated with waves, they would have navigated with seabird appearances out there. They would have obviously celestial navigation using the North Star, the Pole Star. They would have used the sun. And if you look at the map, it's kind of due north. If you leave Galicia, you go north and you arrive in Ireland. So if you use celestial navigation with the Pole Star, you can't miss it. So all of that I folded into this piece. But I wanted to bring in an element of Yamagin, obviously. So I used the Song of Yamagin in the original medieval Irish in the background of the piece, which is stretched along the wall, 12 meters long, cut into bronze, and it's illuminated at night and set into the wall.
Holger's also a builder of traditional boats, of curraghs and navogues. So the seafaring elements in the Song of Amagin gave the project an immediate appeal.
I'm using two kinds of curraghs. I use a local Kerry navogue, which is a big four-hander navogue. And I also use a Donegal curragh, a Dunfanaghy curragh, which would have been much closer to the boats which would have been used in prehistoric times, right to medieval times, which is literally made out of hazel rods and lashed together with twine. And it's very flexible. Somebody once described it to me that it's almost like a seagull. It behaves like a seagull on the ocean. It kind of goes with the waves, it moves sideways. The boat itself twists when you go over a wave. You feel the wave going through the boat. You can visually experience it. You see it, how it moves through it. So you're much closer to the water. You sit right in the water and you only have literally 3-4 inches under you. So it's not like a wooden boat which drives through a wave, but it goes over the waves and moves with the swell. And it's a very poetic way of being out on the water.
The Book of Invasions was written to serve a particular purpose, and no doubt that purpose coloured the content. The medieval scribes set out to create a history of Ireland that placed the main events along a parallel path with events in the Bible. And they sought to show the Irish as the descendants of a noble race. In this version of Ireland's history, it's said that Cæsar, the granddaughter of Noah, is the first to arrive here. This is before the flood. Cæsar and her group are followed by the people of Partholon, and after these we have Nemed and his people. But all these groups are either wiped out by plague or forced to abandon the island. They're followed by the Fervolig, who were said to have escaped captivity in Greece at the same time that Moses and the Israelites escaped from Egypt. In turn, they're defeated in bloody battle by the next group of invaders, the Tuatha De Danann. And finally, and most significant of all, we have the coming of the Milesians, whose arrival was said to correspond with the time of the birth of Christ. Amagin and the Milesians defeat the Tuatha De Danann with superior skills, and Amagin is depicted as an exemplary figure.
We see that Amagin has to use his wit, he has to use his sense of good judgment, he has to use his way in which of understanding the river goddesses here in this island and bringing them on side. That is how he wins against the Tuatha De Danann. But that also parallels the importance of the poet and the power of the poet as seen in early Irish society. And so it is not some druidic warrior who has his trickery and spells. It is a man of good judgment, and he has everything about, you know, he has all the attributes that we need in a well-adjusted world. And I suppose you have to really think about kingship. Kingship in early Irish society is so important. And when you have a right and a dutiful king, the world goes well. When they are giving rightful judgments, when they are acting kingly, everything is right in the world. When a king makes a wrong judgment, this is when there is famine. This is when things go wrong, right? So there's that real connection to the land with who holds kingship.
Billy McGlynn is a folklorist, archaeologist, and musician, and the Song of Amagin has long held a fascination for him.
In the evidence that we have for poets in early medieval Ireland suggests that they enjoyed an extremely high status, you know, on par with kings and religious leaders. And they are considered to be Nevid status, the sacred people. We know that their poetry was considered to be a sacred art and a sacred craft, and the poets themselves promoted the idea that they drew the strength and power of their poetry from the other world. Also, from the early medieval period, we know that the way poets recited or chanted their poems may have been done in a musical way, they very often performed in the early medieval period with harpers or with lyre players. So this kind of chanting, this repetitive chanting, or, you know, sung or at least semi-sung, this chanted style of recitation was probably part of their art. So the interaction between poetry and music and the division, we see that all the way through Irish poetry, you know, some of our finest poems are songs as well, and some of our finest songs began life as poems.
I am a flood spreading out on the plain. I am a salmon swift in the pool. I am a wild boar red and enraged. I am a flower the fairest of all. I make a flame, a fire in the mind. I am the seed of all honor and skill. I am the urge in the heart of the blind. I am a spear sharpened ready to kill. Who is it explains the moon and the mountains? Who raises the stars in the sky? Who descends with the sun to its deep secret home? Who cries in the wind if not I?
I've studied the poem in its mythological context and its historical context, and there's lots of different ways in which you can look at it. But my favourite way to look at it is purely as a piece of art, as a piece of poetry in and of itself. And I find it extremely powerful, the concept that the poet is identifying with the land itself. And, you know, there's all these ideas about the proper ownership of the land, the proper stewardship of the land, how one should interact and be in the land and in the wider world. And I think it has a very powerful message for us if we could, as a species, identify with this natural world in which we live, and see it as an extension of us, or see us as an extension of it, then I think that's a very beautiful and a very significant way for us to see ourselves and our role on the planet and indeed in the universe. And for a 21st century people who are facing, you know, the biggest extinction event in millions of years, I think we could all do with a stronger identification with the planet and the natural world from which we evolved, and we would do very well to heed its message. It's amazing, it's profound that this ancient poem, this relatively short ancient poem, could have such a powerful and resonant message for the 21st century and for people for all time, I think.
While there isn't any direct reference to Christ or the Christian vision in the Song of Amagin, there isn't anything that runs counter to the beliefs of the medieval monks who transcribed it either. And perhaps the Christian understanding of God as being at the centre of all things is in harmony with the basic premise of the song. Amagin expresses himself in the present tense throughout. He doesn't say, I was the wind or I will be the wind, but I am the wind. And he remains in the present moment. I am the sound of the sea. I am the hawk on the cliff. I am the salmon in the pool. One can't help but be reminded of the Old Testament name given to the Creator, Yahweh. I am who am. And is there an echo of the Song of Amagin in some of the lines in the prayer known variously as St. Patrick's Breastplate and the Deer's Cry?
I arise today through the strength of heaven, the light of the sun, the radiance of the moon, the splendor of fire, the speed of lightning, the swiftness of wind, the depth of the sea, the stability of the earth, the firmness of rock. Christ with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me.
Christ with me.
Amigan begins the song by declaring, "I am the wind on the sea," and one is reminded of the opening lines in Genesis, where we're told that the breath of God moved upon the face of the waters before the birth of the light.
The Hebrews called the Spirit the breath. The Ruach means the breath. So Spirit is not some ghost or some idea or something. It's the breath of life in us. It's the divine breath within us. It's our goodness, our kindness, our creativity, our fun, our sense of wonder, our intelligence. This is all transmitted in the breath. It's a whole thing. It's something within us. It's not just when we hear a beautiful piece of music, it just hasn't been contrived in the head, or a beautiful poem. It has, the whole human part of the poet has almost, you could say, it has worked with the poet's originality, his spirit, or her originality, or her creativity to create, to co-create this beautiful piece of work that we resonate with. And there's deep truths here. And if those truths aren't present, it's an ephemeral, it's something that passes. It has ephemeral value. It just comes and it dies. But if it resonates, no matter what it's about, and everything has its place. You know, I'm not just talking about Fauré's Requiem or the great masterpieces. There, it can be found in everywhere. Everything has its place.
Of standing stones just outside Waterville on the road to Cahadaniel, known as Irtokua. It's an archaeological site infused with the Milesian myth because legend has it that Sgeina, the wife of Amagin, who died at sea on the journey to Ireland, is buried here. Paddy Bush again.
From the road as you pass by in a car, it looks just like a low hill. It's when you go up there and you stand near the stones, you see what an extraordinarily dominant place it is. To the southwest, you have Bolas Head and Hog's Head. To the north, you have the lake, Loch Ligdach or Loch Caron. And you can see a huge amount of from the place. It was obviously a site of ritual importance in pre-Christian times. The stones, the standing stones themselves, are probably originally there since the Bronze Age, and they mark, they're aligned on the setting sun on Midwinter's Day, which appears to sit on the top of the hill out at Ceanwicca or Hog's Head. The interesting thing about that alignment is that in recent excavations by Michael Connolly there, the county archaeologist, there seems very strong evidence that the standing stones were also in use and may have been repositioned in the Christian era. So this marking of the midwinter sunset is something that continued on for thousands of years past the Bronze Age into the Christian era. And after all, when we think about it, there's no biblical reference that says the 25th of December is the birth of Christ. It's certainly set in winter, but this midwinter thing, it was obviously the Christianization of an existing midwinter festival. And I think that's embodied in those standing stones at Irtokua. And the view from there, the lake, the sea, and so much of the landscape involved in the Milesian things is from there. It's an extraordinarily resonant sight.
We are birds on the same tree, sailors on the same sea. We are servants of the same flame. You know me, sweet wine of your smile. I can't say that I wait for you, but I was here when you came through. La 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 la. This flower is still opening for the sun of the new morning. La 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 la.
Song of Amagin has been claimed as the first Irish poem because it's said that it was the Milesians who brought the Irish language here. But the poet Paula Meehan challenges this notion because, of course, the Tuatha De Danann, who were driven underground by the Milesians, would also have had their poets and artists.
The poem I wrote, of course, was going to be argumentative because while it might be one of the very early and even the first poem written down, Amargain certainly wasn't the first poet on the island. So I write in the voice of a poet, a female poet of the Tuatha, and she's watching the ships coming over the waves, arriving, landing, and the aftermath, the immediate aftermath, in the knowledge that she's going to have a conversation with the newcomers and with the poet of the newcomers, because that's what poets do, because poets are only the carriers of the language they make poems in. So I write in her quite argumentative voice, which is close to my own argumentative voice. So I take issue with the appropriation of the island through language, which is a pattern that repeats over and over. And eventually, of course, we have to make poetry in the new language. Meanwhile, back at the Rath, I walk through the gathered children listening. Strange news come last night with the turning tide. I dream the shape of what the new tide brings. Taste of copper, the salty taste of blood. The last light of winter, a blackbird sings. I crawl on my belly to meet our dead into the stone heart of the Rath, daughter of water, remembering the future. Lit by the first new moon of the new year, a slender lantern in the starry black, I went to the well of the mad for cure, the wind like ice on the nape of my neck. Hoarfrost spangled silver birch, lake water, mirrored willow, alder, each falling flake of snow that settled on the sleeping swans, tucked up in their feather beds of down. In our stories, there's a woman whose feet are the wrong way round. When she's coming close, it seems she runs away. It's hard to meet her. Dangerous to see her golden face. There are riddled meanings few can translate. Our words are birds, they fly, they leave no trace. We ask creatures to tell us what they're called. That is the way we've learned to name our world. If there must be reckoning, let it be here beside this winter hearth, migrant birds honking overhead. You, stranger, might see the self-same images in flames. Though words may fail us, let's start with the word for free and dream the trails it might point us towards. Your hand in my hand as earnest of trust. Not because we want to, because we must. I see the book of invasions written, a swarm of black bees, a flock of black sheep, the finned, the furred, the feathered, frozen for all time. In the scribe's scraped skin they sleep, to quicken in my ink-filled bowl of bronze, stags of seven tines, salmon from pools, leap from the briary script to my open heart, blessing bestowed with each ancestral charm. Thank you.
Over Nine Waves was presented and produced by JJ O'Shea. Contributors included teacher David Ellison, folklorists Kelly Fitzgerald and Billy Mag Flynn, and boat builder Holger Lunze. The poet Paddy Bush read from his own translation of the Song of Amargan, and Paula Meehan read her poem, Meanwhile Back at the Rath. My Love Was a River was sung by Muireann NicOuliffe, and Birds on the Same Tree was sung by Emma Langford. J.J. O'Shea's own setting and translation of the Song of Amargan was sung by Charlie O'Brien, with various arrangements of the melody played by harpist Radun Schlesinger, guitar player Paul de Grey, and piper and whistle player Barry Lynch. The lyric feature is available to podcast from the RTE Radio Player and from other well-known platforms. We welcome your comments and observations by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.